This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharit Abdullah and you've tuned in to The Breakfast Grill. Joining me on The Breakfast Grill this morning is Chris Skinner, a commentator on the financial markets and fintech through his blog, thefinancer.com, as well as an author of the digital bank Value Web and its new sequel, Digital Human. Now, he is speaking to us today on the topic of the rapid development that are taking place in fintech world and the repercussions that are likely to come about as a result. So, Chris, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Chris, we are well aware of the importance and the need of digital transformation in today's connected and borderless world. Is there a downside in transforming and innovating too fast? Are there any exceptions to this paradigm?
Well, I think the real issue is that a lot of companies are not actually transforming at all. They're doing what they've always done and looking at digital tools as something that they can implement to do what they've always done cheaper and faster and better, rather than trying to rethink the model of what they're doing. And in particular, it's true in banks, which is the market that I mainly deal with, because a lot of the banks are adding technology and adding digital tools to their old business model, rather than transforming their business to be fit for the 21st century. And that's a big challenge that I talk about and deal with every day.
You've spoken quite extensively on the case of M-Pesa and of Kenya, as well as Paytm of India, where, you know, simple introduction of technology could result to more simple and more efficient transaction, hence leapfrogging conventional infrastructure. How will this impact the development cycle of a country when certain stages are being bypassed?
I mean, Bill Gates said in the 1990s that we need banking, but we don't need banks anymore. And for an unusual instance, Bill Gates was completely wrong. We need banks, and we will always need banks, because they provide a trusted value store and trusted intermediation of finance between individuals and institutions. And the reason for that trust is because they're licensed by governments and backed by government structures and regulations. The average bank has five times more regulation than the average technology company. And that's the reason why, is that they have to be trusted to store money and to intermediate money. But what we're seeing is a reimagination of banking in the Southern Hemisphere, and particularly in countries like China and India, where the infrastructure was not as old as the infrastructure that's being used in Europe and America. So one of the key things I talk about a lot is the way in which companies like Ant Financial, which is the payments company for Alibaba in China, is reimagining money. So if you are a merchant on the Alibaba platform Taobao, you can take out a loan for the next few hours or the next couple of days. You don't have annual loans. And the reason why that's a reimagination is that if you're doing things digitally, you can do things for a few seconds in real time. You don't have to talk about an annual product. And the only reason why banks talk about annual loans and insurance companies talk about annual insurances is, in the old physical structure of distributing stuff, it was too expensive to do things on a more regular basis. Now, in the digital world, you can reimagine that and do things on a real-time basis for the next few minutes or hours or seconds. And that's where I think the Paytms in India, the M-Pesas in Kenya, the Alibaba and Alipay in China are doing things completely differently to the way in which traditional banks and traditional insurance companies have done things. And we can learn a lot of lessons from these companies.
Chris, we understand that all this change, this introduction of technology could simplify some processes, and reimagining those processes, of course, it creates cost savings as well as efficiency. But at the same time, I mean, we hear a lot of disruption taking place. Don't you think that enough focus has been made to actually solve the issue of poverty, instead of the focus has always been about efficiency and cost savings?
I think there's two themes here. One is that because doing things on digital platforms is cheap and easy, it's incredibly inclusive. And so we're seeing anybody who can get access to the mobile phone network being able to not just talk, but to trade and transact and to get access to financial services. Just a decade ago, you know, 2 out of 3 people on planet Earth had no access to banking and finance. Now everybody on Earth has access to banking and finance thanks to digital inclusion. But I think the other side of the discussion, which is what you're really referring to, is the fact that machines can make most people redundant because they can do our jobs.
That's right.
And one of the key areas that will develop over time is what are the things that machines cannot learn? So obviously machines can learn anything that's facts or stats or dates or accounting or anything to do with numbers, but they can't create art or music or play sport. They can imitate some of those things, but they can't actually do those things. So we need to focus on the things that machines cannot learn. And then equally, there's a whole new raft of industries coming through, such as fintech. So if you look at people losing jobs in banks, where are they going? Well, quite a lot of them are actually starting new technology companies. Some of the most successful fintech companies were started by former bankers. And equally, we've got a whole new industry exploring space that's emerging. And so there'll be a raft of jobs in space exploration in the next few decades. Equally, machines, even if they are learning things, have to be maintained. So if you're using artificial intelligence, it can only learn what we tell it to learn. So we have to have teachers of the machines and then people who maintain those machines when they go wrong. Because quite often, machines learn the wrong things. A great example being Amazon deployed artificial intelligence for job recruitment, and the machine learned that Amazon should only employ men because that's what they historically favored. And that was the wrong thing to learn. It was just based on historical correlation. So you have to then retrain the machine to get things right. And so there's going to be plenty of jobs in the future. I don't see everyone becoming redundant, but I do see a lot more people being creative and doing arts and sport.
And Chris, the job that you have earlier listed, some of the jobs that will be created as a result of artificial intelligence and so forth, they do require a workforce that is high-skilled in comparison to the abundance of low-skilled workers that we have today. Now, again, I guess it brings me back to that question, whether or not innovation is moving too fast and it's leaving a lot of people behind.
I think innovation and technology is actually bringing all people to the same level playing field. We historically have had a lot of people who, because they were unskilled and uneducated, were ignored by governments and ignored by the system. The fact is, if you look at what technology has achieved in the last few decades, most countries that had a lot of people in poverty have been raised out of poverty. And I don't necessarily believe that will be always sustainable. But what I do see happening is technology moving us all to a level where we can get a basic level of human rights that includes not having to live in a field without any shelter. That's something that is good for everyone on planet Earth. And so technology is actually far more inclusive than exclusive.
So Chris, let's move on to another subject. Now, the media is focused on Facebook developing its own cryptocurrency, the stable coin. Now, what do you make of this introduction?
Well, first of all, it's exciting because anything that's been developed by a company that has over 2 billion users is important. And so the idea of a Facebook stablecoin is really exciting and interesting. They've got Visa, MasterCard, and Uber and others now investing and partnering with this development. We don't quite know what form it's going to take yet, but I'm assuming it's going to be some form of US dollar-backed currency that can be used between Facebook users, peer-to-peer, one-to-one, on a global basis. And so that's a huge development and hugely important. On the other hand, I would never trust Facebook with keeping my money and storing my money because I don't trust them with storing my data anymore after what they've been doing with my data for the past few years. So the idea of it being anything to do with banking, I find morally reprehensible. I just don't see that they will ever be trusted to be a financial store of my money, but a transactional data provider between two individuals of a payment. Yep, I can trust them probably to do that.
Basically, what's the bottom line, Chris? I mean, do you think that the positive outweighs the negative with regards to this introduction?
Well, I think what's going to be really interesting is to see how governments look at Facebook becoming something to do with finance. In the USA, It tends to be that they segregate financial operations from commercial operations and from social media through regulation. And I know that the regulation in the US has already got their alarms ringing over the Facebook stablecoin, but they probably can't do much about it because Facebook's registered the currency in Switzerland, which is a neutral nation. What they could only do, I think, is probably regulate US domestic operations of Facebook and what they do in US territories. So it's going to be interesting just to see how the regulatory structures play out with the Facebook currency.
Okay, we'll touch on issues with regards to regulation. But before that, the idea of cryptocurrency going mainstream, especially with government mandates in some cases, strike you as ironical, given how some might describe, you know, blockchain's beginnings as originally, you know, anarchic?
Cryptocurrencies are now over a decade old. And, 10 years since Bitcoin was released, how many people are actually using Bitcoin or a cryptocurrency in their daily lives to pay for their newspapers or for their suites? I don't really know anybody in my circle of friends who does that. And if you know anybody, I'd be fascinated to hear about it. Most cryptocurrency is viewed as being something that governments don't like because governments prefer fiat currencies, their own currencies, rather than something on the internet. But what's going to happen is it's quite clear if you've got a global network for trading, which we have today on the internet, then you need some form of global currency for that global network. And so I believe what's more likely to happen over time is that national banks and national regulators and national governments will start to issue their own digital currencies. And maybe there will be a G20 currency that becomes a global currency backed by renminbi from China and the US dollar and maybe the euro. So these things are developing all the time, but it's quite clear that over time we will see a global digital currency exchange platform to support the network. And I don't think it'll be Bitcoin or a cryptocurrency. I think it'll be something that's actually issued and regulated by governments.
Brilliant. Just hold on there, Chris. Joining us on The Breakfast Grill this morning is Chris Skinner, an independent commentator of TheFinancer.com. Now, we'll come back for more discussions with Chris on the rise of virtual banks. So stay tuned on BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
You've tuned into BFM 89.9. On The Breakfast Grill this morning is Chris Skinner, an independent commentator on TheFinancer.com. Now, Chris, earlier we spoke about the rise of cryptocurrency, but another area that is fascinating in the fintech world is the virtual bank. Now, we are looking at the emergence of these banks, particularly in Hong Kong as well as Singapore. In your opinion, now, how will this development impact the conventional banks?
Well, I mean, if you look at the banks, the virtual banks that are getting licenses in Hong Kong so far, for example, a lot of them are actually backed by large financial institutions as well as the technology giants. So it's bringing together a merger of the technology and financial markets, which is what fintech's all about. And equally, launching a new bank that's a digital-focused bank first and foremost means that it can start with a very different view of the world to the traditional banks who, as I mentioned earlier, are just doing what they've always done cheaper and faster with technology. And what we've seen emerging, for example, in the UK, where challenger banks are now 4 or 5 years old, is that the ones that are the most successful are providing a huge information enrichment of people's financial lifestyles, which is analyzing all of their data of their transactions and telling them how they're living their lives in terms of how they're spending on entertainment, on clothes, on transport, and for every transaction, showing them where it was, when it was, and linking that into Google Maps, for example, so you can actually see a photo of the place where you made that payment. These are things that traditional banks can't do easily, if at all, because traditional banks typically have a very old system at the back end that was developed for just keeping debits and credits, not actually providing information enrichment. And what we've ended up with in the UK as a result is the traditional banks still might get my salary and my income paid into that account, but then all of my lifestyle spending is in the new bank, which is the new virtual digital bank, because they're providing me all this understanding of how I'm living my life. And what's happening with the old bank is they're just getting to pay my mortgage and my tax and my council bills and my utility bills. So boring old bank gets boring old transactions. Exciting new bank gets all of my financial lifestyle. And that's becoming quite a clear trend, which I think will be repeated in Hong Kong and Singapore and in other markets.
And Chris, considering the performance of the major banks today, now fintech or, you know, as you would word it, tech fin, where would you place your bet on?
Yeah, you've also been reading some of my stuff. So
Absolutely.
I do talk about fintech as parent-child relationship, where the parent is the financial markets, which are traditional, old, and they want stability and security and reliability. And the tech is the young that wants to challenge the world, change the world, and kick everything and question everything. And that's what we're seeing with the way in which a lot of the fintech startups view the world. They don't understand why banks are regulated the way they're regulated, and they want to challenge everything about how financial products and services are developed and sold. And eventually they have to end up working with the banks because they realize there is a reason why they work the way they work and why they're trusted the way they are. When I talk about tech fin, I'm really getting at, again, Tencent with WeChat Pay and Alibaba Ant Financial with Alipay, and the scale and radical thinking they have, along with what we see in a lot of the African nations, in Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand, and all parts of the world, where technology has been deployed as a brand new way of thinking about how to do finance rather than just doing what was traditional finance faster and cheaper. And over time, what I think will start to develop is a very personalized, proactive, predictive model of providing me financial lifestyle analytics. Whether I'm someone who's living on a very low income or high income, it doesn't matter because, as I said before, digital platforms cost the same for a transaction, whether you're transacting 1 cent or $1 million. So it really will start to become a very inclusive service that, with technology first, provides something completely different to what we've seen historically. And yeah, Alibaba with Ant Financial has proven this. They just launched a new health insurance product a couple of months ago, and they got 50 million people taking out health insurance in just 6 weeks because they can and because it's easy. And that's the sort of thing I think we'll see being replicated around the world.
Okay, so Chris, I mean, we're clear about the scale that they're reaching as well as the inclusive nature of all this new technology that has been introduced. We're also impressed by the sheer speed of how these technologies are being implemented. At the end of the day, I mean, if we were to place a comparison between the financial sector and the technology sector, financial sector has seen quite a sort of stable increase with regards to innovation, so hence regulators are able to cope. On the subject of technology, can regulators cope with the speed of innovation? Should government intervene to allow regulators to keep up so that they can understand the implications of all these innovations that are taking place?
I mean, quite clearly, regulators are an extension of governments. They're normally within the Treasury operations of government. And regulators can only regulate what they see. And quite often, therefore, there's a lot of unintended consequences and unforeseen actions that occur, which they can only regulate once they see them. If the regulator had known what's going to happen with complex derivatives before the 2008 financial crisis in America, there wouldn't have been one. And equally in Asia in 1997, 98, if they'd seen the crisis coming in the financial markets, there wouldn't have been one. The thing about technology is that technology is different because it's viewed by regulators as something that's more like a plaything rather than a core thing. And when it becomes a core thing, then they start to get worried. And this is where the markets are starting to come together and become quite interesting, because if I lose a selfie on Facebook, it doesn't matter. If I lose $1 million on Facebook currency, of course it matters. And so that's where we're going to start to see this new hybrid regulation model come through as technology and finance come together. But the regulators find that quite difficult because a lot of regulators have people who came from banks and financial institutions as their developers of their policies, and they don't have technologists and engineers, and that's starting to change. So you're seeing this movement to a new hybrid model, and eventually in about a decade, we won't even talk about fintech. It'll just be finance that happens to run on technology. But today we're talking about it because banks typically are run by bankers, regulators are run by people who came from banks. And now we need engineers and developers and coders. And a great example for me is, you know, if you look at JP Morgan Chase, for example, a third of their people are now people in technology. Goldman Sachs, a quarter of their people are people in technology. In most banks, you're seeing 25% to 50% of their employees being developers, engineers, designers, coders, rather than people who are financial accountants and bankers. And that's something that's a good thing, in my view, because it's been something that's been required for a long time, and it's now actually happening.
Okay, Chris, in the meantime, while we see that shift in manpower, for example, more technologists in the regulatory scenes, for example, you know, to keep up with the pace, again, with that question of the speed of innovation, should government intervene, you know, so that they could allow regulators to keep up, so that they could understand the technology even more, you know, so that they could avoid bad things from, you know, perhaps if there are any bad implications that could come from all this new emerging technologies?
Well, governments and regulators would only intervene if it was destabilizing the economy or the country. And the challenge in that statement is, at what point does the government regulator realize that it's destabilizing the economy and the country? So, you know, when Bitcoin appeared, a lot of governments feared it because they thought it could destabilize their economies and their countries. A lot of countries tried to ban it, and not all succeeded, but some have succeeded. So China, for example, has completely outlawed anything to do with Bitcoin trading or investing. And if you're a Chinese citizen today, it's virtually impossible to get money into that cryptocurrency. And that's where they have intervened, because they saw it as destabilizing the economy in the country. On the obverse of that discussion, if you look at peer-to-peer lending in China, the government didn't intervene. They allowed that to develop and flourish and grow until there were thousands of companies doing peer-to-peer lending. And then they finally changed the rules because they realized that it actually could cause problems for not just citizens, but for the country as a whole through shadow financing. And when they changed the regulations, at one point last year, about five peer-to-peer lenders were going bankrupt every day. And when they went bankrupt, losing thousands of yuan on behalf of the Chinese consumers who invested in those companies. So, you know, it really is a case of getting the balance right. If you leave it too late, then you get the disaster of peer-to-peer lending that we saw in China. If you do it too early, then potentially you can get those problems nipped in the bud, as they did with Bitcoin.
Okay, Chris, one last question before we end our interview for today. Based on your observation, and you know, you've worked with a lot of regulators and tech players in different platforms, where are they now?
Well, I mean, I've been working in this area for a long time, but I guess fintech in its current form is just over 10 years old. You know, probably the first fintech company I ever met was in 2005. So the regulators have taken a long time to catch up, but they have caught up. I mean, the UK regulator set a precedent when they launched an innovation team and a sandbox for experimentation under the regulatory authority's watch. Then that was taken on board by Singapore, by Hong Kong, by Dubai. And we're now seeing most countries getting into technology under the watch of the central bank and the regulator. And a great example of that is being here in my FinTech Week here in Kuala Lumpur this week. You know, it's the first time that Bank Negara has held this conference. It's sold out. It's really well attended. And it's showing that the banks, the governments, the regulators are not just letting this run alongside and happening outside their authority. They're actually stimulating and supporting it, which is a great move.
On that note, I'd like to thank you for speaking to us on The Breakfast Grill today. I've been speaking to Chris Skinner, an independent commentator on thefinancer.com. You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shahid Abdullah for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Now with faster speeds every day. Barula Bes.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.